The defining characteristic of a quality mentor is that they have, in all their decisions, high opportunity cost. Their time is very valuable, especially relative to where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have time, especially really good mentors, to go to a mentorship event.
Lurking around at mentorship events with people who can't help them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Drinking like bad coffee or like bad wine and like wearing a name tag, trying to shake hands with like clammy-handed people, right?
Right, it's right.
Like, no, they just don't have time for that stuff. There are some exceptions, but the vast majority of the time, if you're just on like meetup.com and you're finding a mentorship event nearby, it's going to be awful for you.
Right.
Example, one of my clients, he went to a mentorship event in Michigan on artificial intelligence. He's a machine learning specialist.
Mm.
He immediately called me after the event and told me, Zach, you were right. I should listen to you more often. He said that the vast majority of people there had no idea what they were talking about, that they had like seen AI in movies and they'd never actually stepped foot.
Oh, through. No.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, these are the kinds of things that show
That's
up.
That's like a Star Trek convention.
I know, exactly. It's like, yes. Instead, it's better to do active outreach than to just like go to these things and think that you're going to bump into these people.
Right.
My advice generally is, as far as events go, because I also have a similar rule about networking events, don't go to networking events. Go to things that they have a secondary or a tertiary benefit of being networking, but their primary benefit is something else.
Okay, yeah.
Right? You're going to be in the same place as other people with similar interests to you, some of whom, especially speakers, are going to be further ahead in their careers than you, right?
Right.
So go to those. I'm not saying don't go to events, but don't go to things that are marketed as a mentorship event or
yeah, it sounds like it'd
event.
Be stuffy anyway. Like it's, you know, just with dating, it'd be better to meet somebody at a party than at a speed dating thing.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is January 14th, 2019. 2019! It's hard to believe. I remember when it was like 1997. You know, that was a year that I lived through. My guest today is a fairly frequent contributor to School Sucks, Zach Slabeck. His website, zachslabeck.com. Zach has a wonderful resource-rich website designed to help young professionals get ahead in their careers. It is a very nice complement to what we do here at schoolsucksproject.com. So he returns today to discuss one chapter from a book that he has coming out probably either late spring, early summer, called How to Get Ahead. We're going to talk about that a little bit on the show today. But today's conversation focuses in on what Zach calls a cabinet of models. Why learn slowly from your own experience when you can learn more rapidly from other people's past experiences and accrued wisdom? So the cabinet of models includes advisors, teachers, and mentors. And when we say teachers, we'll flesh all this out for you. We're not talking about your eighth grade social studies teacher, Mr. Tilden, with his elastic waistband Dockers covered in chalk dust. We're talking about a new definition of teacher for the 21st century. People who have a skill and want to deliver that skill to other people online for a price, because their transmission of knowledge is worth money in a marketplace. What do you think of that, Mr. Tilden? Oh, he's asleep. So we'll make the distinctions between advisors, teachers, and mentors. We'll talk about the desirable attributes you should look for in each. We'll talk about the time frames. How long should you plan to maintain each of these relationships? What type of knowledge are you looking for in each relationship? And how much weight should you give them in the context of your overall career goals? Then we'll dig a little bit deeper into mentors specifically. Zach and I will talk about his approach to landing the right mentor. You heard a preview of that in the beginning of the show. And unfortunately, back through the time I was going through school, right up until the present day, this is one thing that is missing for a lot of young people, especially people going through the school process: meaningful and enriching relationships with adults. The apprenticeship model has all but vanished, something that too few young people have access to today. So this is a show for self-directed learners who are looking to be an exception to that rule. If you're interested in the bigger picture, please visit Zach's site, zachslabeck.com, and schoolsucksproject.com. Search self-directed education and you'll find a collection of great resources. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. Zach Slabeck, welcome back to the Studio of Champions.
Thanks for having me, Brett. I'm glad to be back.
Update on the name. We were talking before we started recording. You know the story of Yinz?
I don't know the story. I mean, my grandmother is from Homestead, you know, outside of Pittsburgh, and she says Yinz, and I've got like an uncle who is like the embodiment of Pittsburgh dad, which,
oh, nice.
If you're listening to this and you're confused about Brett's obsession with Pittsburgh since moving here, which is totally understandable if you've never been to Pittsburgh, just search Pittsburgh dad and you will understand a lot of the culture once you watch these YouTube videos.
Yeah.
They're good representation of what like old Pittsburgh is like. But no, I don't know the story.
First of all, I think I should tell people that Yinz is a term that is used here. I think it is unique to this region, and it is a second person plural. The origin of this, I was reading about it because I was curious, was Scots-Irish people were trying to resolve the problem of second person pronouns, you know? This is before, well before the age of pronoun problems. You know, first person pronouns, you have I or us. Third person pronouns, you have him or them. But second person, you can kind of do double, you know, singular or plural. So people who were not native speakers were trying to develop a way to make this work. And it started as you ones.
Well, I mean, to be fair, like, a lot of the other cultures that were here in Pittsburgh had second person plural in their language. Like in German, there are second person plural words. And I don't know Slovak, but I imagine that there are second person plural words in like Slovak and Ukrainian as well. So like English is kind of weird in the sense, like I remember when I was learning German that my German instructor had to explain to me, yes, this word means you, but it means like the plural you, like all of you, or because I grew up in Pennsylvania, she said, or this is kind of like when someone says Yinz.
Yeah. So eventually U1s became Yinz. And then out in the eastern part of the state, central and eastern part of the state, they say Ewins.
You more often hear use.
Use.
You'll hear use like in the mainline Philadelphia region.
Oh, all the way up to New York. PA. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Use guys.
Use guy. You'll hear use guys. Use.
Mm-hmm. And then down south we have y'all. So Yinz is our y'all.
Yep.
Basically. Cool. So you are here today to discuss a book that you have coming out this spring in May, you said?
Spring, early summer. We're still tentatively set right now for May 31st, but this is one of the first conversations I've had about it.
Title of the book is How to Get Ahead Thoroughly, subtitled A Proven Six-Step System to Unleash Your Personal Brand and Build a World-Class Network So Opportunities Come to You.
I will tell you, I'm very proud of that subtitle because that took – of everything we did in this book between me and my team at McGraw-Hill, this was the most contentious thing, was the subtitle.
What are the subtitle rules?
You know, I think it changes between publishers, and I imagine that different publishers and different editors have their own preferences. You know, I've got a great editor. She was very, very helpful. She went to bat for me a couple times. But it's kind of a committee decision, right?
Yeah.
Between the author, the editor, the sales team, and then the actual editorial board, right?
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, like I really like the three-step subtitle that you'll find in a lot of books where it'll be like title and then 1, 2, 3, like the things you'll get out of it. So the 4-Hour Workweek does this really well. It's like the 4-Hour Workweek, you know, escape the 9-to-5, live anywhere, and become the new rich or something like that.
Right.
For whatever reason, my team did not like the three parts step, but they were okay with like two parts.
Yeah.
Like, okay, whatever. So this was the most contentious part of it.
But interesting.
It is proven. And the way that the book works is, this is something I point out in the introduction, I like books that you can pick up and you can turn to any chapter. And you could read that chapter independently and get a lot out of that book. Mm-hmm. This is actually one of the reasons I was super excited about the opportunity to work with McGraw-Hill in particular, because their books are very tactical.
Yeah.
They're very crunchy. Like, you pick it up, you turn to a chapter, there's a lot of stuff you can use immediately. It's not a lot of fluff. But the book also has a whole is greater than the sum of its parts kind of structure to it. So you can use it as a step 1 through 6, and you'll get a lot out of it for understanding your career, taking your career to the next level, whether you're changing careers, you're just starting your career, or you're doing something on the side to your current career.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also turn to it and say, I am really bad at networking, or I want to get a lot better at networking.
Yeah, you can parse it to what you need.
Right. So
yeah,
you can awesome. You can jump to chapter 5, which is all about networking.
Right.
And you can just use that chapter. So
awesome. Well, today we are going to focus on chapter 2, which is called Shave Years Off Your Learning Curve, Learn from the Best and Land Great Mentors. And we agreed that this was a really important set of skills and knowledge for young professionals, people who are self-directed learners. We obviously talk a lot on School Sucks about self-education. But I really think that making the distinction between, maybe people just picture some young person sitting around and struggling to figure everything out on his or her own. What we're talking about is self-direction, which also means being able to identify when you need help from others. And I've seen lots of great examples of this with the unschoolers and autodidacts that I've worked with through the years back when I was tutoring, and the people that I've met through my travels. So we are going to go in depth on the show today about what you call in the chapter a cabinet of models, mm-hmm. right? Now, it is certainly possible and likely you will need all three at some point in your career. We're talking about people who can advise you, people who can teach you, and people who can mentor you. And as I was reading the chapter, I was thinking, gosh, did I ever have any of these things for what I do now? And I think the answer is yes, but I think I never made those relationships explicit. Yep. So before we get into what each one is, do you think that making it a really deliberate process is important? Because people are going to mentor you here and there. People are going to advise you here and there. And people might even teach you something specific. I've certainly had all three of those, but it was never like a clarified ongoing relationship. You know, I think about I'm in a mastermind group. You ever been in a mastermind group?
Not formally, but I know what they are.
You have any interest in it?
Depends on how much time I have.
It's 1 hour a week,
yeah.
Usually.
It's one of those things where it's like, I broke my own rule.
Yeah.
I've got a very strong rule that I harp on in the book in particular, which is never go to networking events.
Mm-hmm.
Because they almost always suck.
Yeah.
Because the type of person who turns out to a networking event, especially one that's like after work on like a weekday,
yeah,
is somebody who is either looking for a job or they're a salesperson. And if you're not looking to employ someone, you're not looking for salespeople, networking events won't help you.
Right.
I broke my own rule and I went to one that was better than most. And I think that masterminds are probably a lot like networking organizations in the sense where it's like the structure matters a lot.
Yeah.
And the specific individual members matter a lot.
Right.
So like you can get into a lot of networking groups and you can get into a lot of masterminds that are just going to like totally waste your time.
Right.
I trust your judgment. So
well,
a referral I would take.
It can certainly be two of these three in your cabinet of models, right? Obviously everybody in the mastermind takes turns as advisors. One person comes to the meeting and sits in the hot seat, they present a pain point. Everybody advises, at least gives their advice on that issue. In my mastermind, a couple of guys are more skilled with copywriting and marketing. So if we have a specific task that relates to one of those things, they can volunteer to take on the role of teacher. Usually, I mean, they could be paid or in some cases unpaid. But, back to what I was saying, I never really clarified these relationships, you know, and this is what I'm looking to get out of this. And, you know, this is when I'm going to move on to something else.
No, and something I also hit on in this chapter in particular is if you want to get a good mentor, mm-hmm. don't go to mentorship events.
Right.
Because a good mentor, in my experience in particular, everyone who has been a fantastic mentor to me If I told them, oh, you're my mentor, they bristled at that. They're like, sure. Ah. A good mentor is someone who has very valuable time, very high opportunity cost to all of their decisions. And you work with them so that you can take some of the tasks that are on their plate that aren't really valuable for them to work on, but yeah. are really valuable for you to work on.
Yeah.
That's the kind of relationship you really want to get with a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
People use mentor in particular as like this catch-all simply to mean anybody who like gives you advice or is more experienced than you.
Right.
And a distinction I want to make, there are mentors and then there are advisors. So a lot of people, when they say, I need a mentor, what they really want is they want someone to give them advice and wisdom and kind of like this retrospective on their career where they were and say, these are kind of the steps that you should follow.
Right. Right.
Whereas a mentor is almost more like a master and an apprenticeship kind of relationship.
Right.
Somebody who can teach you a lot of the tacit knowledge that just takes years and years of work to build up. But before we get into all of those kinds of details, something that I just want to say is this cabinet of models idea isn't just something like I pulled out of the ether. I think for a lot of people, myself included, they look back on their careers and they see, oh, did I have these people? Yes, I did. It wasn't just formalized like this.
Yeah.
So I think like the formalized structure gives people a place to say, what is the next thing I need to learn, or how do I get to the next level in my career? Okay, there are a couple different types of people I could pull on. How do I go pull on them?
Right. I think if you put too much weight, like through the lack of clarification, you can put too much weight on one person mm-hmm. filling some kind of advisory role. And then there could be a specific skill set or a specific endeavor. And this person could simply say, well, I never did that and I'm fine. And you go, all right, well, I'm looking up to this person. I don't need to do that. So being able to do this kind of plug in and unplug from people, not in a cold way, but just like, you know, there's times when you move beyond teachers, there's times when you move beyond advisors, and there's times when you move beyond mentors.
Absolutely.
So knowing what you want, clarifying your goals, I think is very important. So you're not just, I mean, we get plenty of instruction on how to blindly follow in this life. Even when we start to tell ourselves a story that we're self-directed and we're entrepreneurial, we can still fall into those bad habits, those kinds of schooled habits. So being really, really conscious of this whole process and understanding your needs at any given stage, I think is really, really important to connecting with the right people.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's just make a distinction between the three, teachers, advisors, and mentors. We'll talk about the desirable attributes of each. And then I really, really want to focus in on mentors because I think, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, they're the most valuable as far as building a network and building a portfolio that can really help you professionally.
I think particularly in building the portfolio, mentors are going to be the most direct route to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also going to be the most direct route to building a strong network. You can have a weak network and a strong network. A strong network is somebody someone with a strong network is somebody who, if they're introduced through, say, a mentor, they instantly get that mentor social proof, right?
Yeah, right.
People instantly take them seriously because they take the mentor seriously.
Right.
Introductions through advisors and teachers, they carry weight, but they don't carry as much weight. So I don't necessarily like saying that one is more important than the other. One will be more important than the others depending on the person and the stage of their career.
Mm-hmm.
But mentors, I think, are the most misunderstood, and I think they are the ones where if you play your cards right with a mentor, you can legitimately shave 5 or more years off of the learning curve of your career.
Sure.
Like I, in the introduction of the book, in the acknowledgments, I point out some of the mentors I've had, and I think we talked previously about Josh Blackman as an example.
Yep.
Josh is a legal scholar in Texas now. He was actually one of the lawyers in the Defense Distributed case, if anyone's familiar with that.
Yep.
But he was one of the first people to tell me, Zach, you should buy ZachSlayback.com and start writing there.
Yeah.
And the things I learned from him through modeling him in a lot of ways, just on like using a personal website, I wouldn't be where I am without him today. I'd be many years behind where I am.
Right.
So just use that as an example.
So let's just make the distinction between the three. Advisor is more of an informal role, if we want to start there.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think of an advisor as simply as anybody to whom you reach out to get advice, mm-hmm. right? Advisors can give you both tactical advice, like these are the steps that I followed, these are the people you should talk to if you want to get hired at this company, something like that. And they can also offer you what I call wisdom, which is kind of like this retrospective self-narrative on one's own career or where they've gone, right?
Right.
Take this with a grain of salt. People are very good at rewriting their own stories without yeah. even knowing it.
Right.
I think advice in a lot of cases is overrated. But often in the case where you are sitting there and you're asking yourself, what do I do next? An advisor might be one of the most valuable people to whom you can reach out. I'll give you as an example. Actually, right before I came over here this morning, I was doing a coaching call with one of my career coaching clients.
Mm-hmm.
Guy's a product manager out at a big company out west, and he's thinking about either taking a promotion or moving to a separate company. He's looking at a couple different things, right? And he asked me, one of the things I want to do if I get this promotion is I want to pitch my boss on letting me do and spend more time on professional development. What do you think I should pitch him on me actually spending that money on as far as like courses or coaching or things like that go? And I told him, you know, I think you could build out a number of different people you could pull on as teachers. You could use a couple of different courses, a couple of different programs, go to different conferences, a number of things, right? But specifically for the career of being a senior product manager, the best thing that he could do is find other people who were or are senior product managers who got to that next level of the game and ask them, what are the things that they studied or wish that they had studied? So those people, in his case, would be advisors.
Okay.
An advisor can be someone you email with once, that you meet with for coffee once, or that you meet with every week.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the most amorphous of these three because it's really just like we're sitting down and I want your input on something.
Okay. So would you describe your role as more of a teacher? You're teaching them how to get ahead professionally.
Yep.
Basically, that's the skill set that they're paying you for.
Absolutely. Okay. I can tell them these are the steps you can follow. And I think one of the things that teachers do really, really well, a good teacher at least, is there is so much information out there today, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So much free information too, which is great, but you also get information overload. It's very easy to just get overwhelmed by how much information there is out there if you want to change careers, if you want to get a new job, if you want to earn more, if you want to be more productive, any number of things, right?
Yeah, and with any kind of knowledge work, with all the new stuff you can learn, if something gets frustrating or you hit a roadblock, I'm saying you like I'm not just talking about me here because this is something that happens to me all the time, right? There's so many new skills to learn. There's so many things that I'm doing that could be improved. And if something becomes frustrating or I hit one of these impasses, I will just switch my attention to something else I need to do, right? Because there's just this waterfall of information coming at me from all different directions that I can just turn another direction and start going that way, which I think is a bad habit. It's kind of a lack of focus. So I think having somebody in a teaching role specifically who can give that whole process structure, and maybe that extends to the other two as well, who are more oriented with big picture because the teacher is more of a narrow focus.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, some of my teachers, I have copywriting teachers. Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm trying to write this headline. What do I do? What resources do I need to help me understand how to write a headline on a sales page?
Right.
I might turn to a copywriting teacher on that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's very tactical. That's very focused. And that's very explicit too. One of the distinctions that I think is important to make when you're thinking about personal and professional development is the difference between explicit knowledge and tacit knowledge. Explicit knowledge is that knowledge which is easily taught, especially through a lecture or a textbook or video. This is the type of knowledge that teachers, in the traditional word of a teacher,
yeah.
can be very good at communicating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas tacit knowledge is much more big picture, and it's something that is largely learned by doing,
mm-hmm.
and it's largely learned by watching and imitation. There's a whole set of literature on how people in general pick up tacit knowledge. But a good teacher is not necessarily good at the thing that you are trying to do, but they are good at teaching the thing you are trying to do. The example that I love to give, because I'm an obnoxious Pittsburgher, is Chuck Knoll.
Ah.
Chuck Knoll was one of the best coaches in NFL history, in Steelers history, right? Took the Steelers from being kind of like a backwater team that were much more like the Cleveland Browns,
yes,
to being a world-winning team, right?
Yep, yep.
Chuck Knoll was a mediocre football player who actually played for the Browns,
mm-hmm,
but he was a great coach. So I like that example because he wasn't actually great at doing the thing of playing football, but he was very good at the thing of teaching how to do football.
Right. So when you use explicit versus tacit knowledge, and my understanding of the word tacit is kind of like what's understood but not said, yeah, right? So like a tacit agreement, there's a feeling in the air that agreement is upon us, right? So I would think that this would be, I'm trying to think of like people that I know that are really expert in their field, or really not expert isn't even the most specific word.
Craftsmen are really good examples of this,
but also comfortable, mm-hmm, right? And they just kind of know the thing to do next, or they know how to zoom out from the problem that you're having and incorporate it into a bigger picture.
Or they know how to make a distinction or a refinement that if you were simply reading it in a textbook or watching it on a YouTube video, you wouldn't necessarily pick up on.
Right.
So a really snobby but good example, actually, I think is wine tasting. Wine tasting is one of those things that like you could – like if you watch videos of wine tasters, they're ridiculous. It's like somebody takes a sip of wine and they're like, oh, I taste black currant and dark cherry and a little bit of fire. So I think this is Spain in 1998. It's like, what? That's ridiculous. And you can't really pick those kinds of things up by right, reading about it. You can get some basic idea, but it's only through doing that many, many times over many, many years that somebody's actually able to develop that palate, right?
Yeah. I mean, with another's, what would be the purpose of watching wine tasting videos other than to watch somebody else taste wine?
They're really obnoxious,
right,
to watch.
Right.
And I say this as someone who's like watched them. they're really obnoxious to watch. But it's one of these things that if you're interested in learning in particular or how people learn, I think it's just a really great example of explicit versus tacit knowledge. Because
sure,
you can go pick up a book that teaches you about, say, wine. And then you could watch someone who's actually doing a tasting and they're nothing alike.
Mm-hmm.
There's this huge disconnect there. And in trades and in a lot of work in general, this is why the apprenticeship system became such a prominent way to teach people to pick up a trade. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You would work under a master, and that master might work as a teacher in one capacity. And they might give you information, stuff to study, but then you'd also watch them. You'd work directly with them, and then they would kind of work as a mentor with you as well.
Yeah.
So they would play both roles. And that's another distinction that I think is important to have here. Somebody can be both a teacher and a mentor. They can be both a teacher and advisor. I just like these categories because they're helpful for thinking about what's the next type of person I need to approach.
Right. So a mentor can focus in or zoom out.
Yep.
Yeah. And just as we continue to make distinctions here, obviously we understand that a teacher relationship is probably the most finite since it's focused on a specific skill or skill set. Do you give any advice for how long these other relationships should last, or how somebody being advised or being mentored should know like when to move on to something bigger or someone else?
Yeah, absolutely. In mentors in particular, like I said, the best mentors in my experience in, you know, like the modern day workplace,
yeah,
they are people who you don't go to them and say like, oh, can you mentor me? You go to them and say, here's stuff that I think I can do for you.
Yeah.
I'd really appreciate the opportunity to work with you.
Right.
When your skills get to the level that the stuff that you can do for them is actually less valuable than the other things you could be spending your time working on and studying, you need to move on to a different mentor.
Right.
Right. As you get better at your trade, as you refine your trade, And as they change too, we have to keep in mind that like these are human beings. They're not like static elements in the world.
Yeah.
As they change, you'll find that when you're spending time working on a project for your mentor as, you know, an assistant or as a junior employee or as just an intern, what, any number of things, right?
Right.
You can be an executive who has mentors, or you can be, you know, an intern in college who has mentors.
Right.
You're going to find that the work I'm doing with the mentor is no longer valuable for me in learning a lot of this tacit knowledge. In fact, if I could hire somebody who's more junior than me to do this work, it's probably time to move on.
Right.
With advisors, again, advisors are a little bit more open-ended. As soon as you get the expertise that you need to move on, my advice to people is keep engaging the advisors. They might be useful nodes in your network.
Yeah.
But they also can have a very short lifespan or a very long lifespan. Some of my advisors, for example, are people who I've only met a handful of times. And in those handful of times I've met them, they've been incredibly helpful. But I might talk to them once every couple of years.
Right.
Right. So the mentor relationship, the advisor relationship doesn't necessarily need to be one that you have to think of as like, oh, I need to meet with my advisor once a month.
Right.
It's not like an advisor in college.
Yeah, exactly. And what was the other part of that? Well, actually, from there, we could talk about the positive attributes of each, mm-hmm. or like what people should be looking for. We can start with advisors and go on to teachers and mentors.
Absolutely. So like I said, an advisor is somebody you need to call on when you need advice, mm-hmm. right? Expertise, input, to hear from somebody who is a couple steps ahead of you or many steps ahead of you and can kind of give you a retrospective.
Right.
The most important thing for them is that they're accessible, that you can get in touch with them, that you can email them, that you can meet with them, that you can get on a phone call with them, right? They should be open to actually having that real conversation with you.
Mm-hmm.
James Altucher has an idea of like vicarious mentors versus like real world mentors.
Right.
Which again, we're looking at some of the weird verbiage here, the difference between a mentor and an advisor. I don't like to think that you can really have vicarious advisors. Advisors are people you actually need to talk to.
Sure.
Because your situation is different than anybody else's situation, and it's different from their situation.
There's a huge industry around it, right? Where people might be ultimately selling a course that's going to teach you something specific, but they kind of build a culture around it that is very more the feel of an advisor or a mentor, even though you never actually get to, you know, talk to that person one-on-one.
Right.
Unless you're paying big bucks beyond the course for, you know, a lot of these guys, especially like in sales and marketing training, they will have some hour phone call with me, several thousand dollars type arrangement.
I can tell you somebody can easily start in the position of being a teacher. So in that case, I think they're a teacher. Right.
Right. Right.
But then they can move into the advisor position as well if you can actually meet with them.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And if they are somebody who has achieved what you want to achieve and they possess expertise, those are two really important characteristics of advisors.
Yeah.
That they've actually achieved what you want to achieve. So if you want to become a top tier salesperson in the software as a service world, right? You might not necessarily want to talk to someone who is a very good Mercedes-Benz salesperson, right? They might be helpful for you for a specific problem.
Yeah.
But if you're asking for advice on how to get into the top tier for software as a service sales, you need to find other software as a service salespeople.
Right.
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 And then that they actually have expertise. I like to think of expertise as pattern recognition. It's the ability to look at something and say, I see a pattern here. And pattern recognition is largely only learned through exposure to many data points, right? In deep learning, artificial intelligence, and machine learning studies, if you want a machine to be able to recognize a picture, say a picture of a cat, you need to feed it thousands of photos of cats and non-cats.
Right.
Anybody who's ever spent time with CAPTCHA, for example, you are helping Google with its pattern recognition skills. Because when CAPTCHA tells you, point out all of the pictures that are that include a storefront, right? Mm-hmm. Is trying to learn what a storefront looks like. You are the expert because you've seen lots of storefronts mm-hmm. compared to the machine, right? Mm-hmm. And you're telling it, these are storefronts and these aren't storefronts. That's what expertise looks like in the case of trying to recognize a storefront. Kind of a silly example, but
right.
this person needs to have exposure to a large data set. I do a little bit of work in venture capital, for example. And I remember when I first started working in this space, asking one of my mentors, you know, how do you recognize a good deal? And he just told me, he's like, it's just pattern recognition. A lot of it's pattern recognition, especially early on. He's had exposure to thousands of data points through his previous experience. So he's able to feel something out that I'm not necessarily able to feel out, right?
Right.
Which is particularly helpful in the mentorship role that he plays for me. But they need to at least possess some kind of expertise. And then I always think it's great if they have their own network.
Right.
In any of these cases, it's great if they have their own network. But especially with an advisor, because you can go to an advisor, you can ask them a couple questions, and they might be able to tell you, actually, I can introduce you to this person who does this or can
right,
help you in
right.
this area. I met with one of my advisors back in October, for example. And I had a personal finance question for him that he was not able to answer. And then he was able to tell me, actually, I can introduce you to my accountant. And because of the place where he is in his career and that he's achieved things that I want to achieve, this specific accountant will be really helpful for me
yeah.
versus one that I would just find walking down the street here in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Right?
Would you say that their network also includes their past teachers? I mean, that's been my experience yep. is an advisor could be very temporary because you reach an impasse and you need to put more hands on the deck to solve some kind of a problem. They pull from their past, right? So again, it's like, it's nice to learn slowly from experience, but it's preferable to learn more rapidly from somebody else's past experience.
Yep.
And they could say, oh, you know, there's this course, there's this free resource. I mean, so many of the people that I've benefited from doing what I do are people that I've never met, never talked to, but people that I did know that were in advisory roles said, go get this. This is my past, you know, this was my past teacher on this thing. And that was really helpful. So I don't know if that's considered part of the network, but
I think that's part of the expertise.
Okay.
The ability to say, I recognize that this particular thing really helped me getting where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if this advisor has ever played a teaching role, they
right.
will be very good at telling you, these are the resources you should pay attention to, and these are the resources you should totally avoid.
Okay. You talk about the weight you should give each person as far as their influence or their advice and what it's worth. How does that go with an advisor?
Advice is a dime a dozen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the better the advisor, the more you should take their advice. The closer that they've achieved something that you want to achieve, especially if that's a really hard thing to achieve,
yeah.
should weigh their advice better and more heavily. But if it's just somebody who, let's say you're at the very beginning of your career, right? And you're coming out of college, you're coming out of high school, whatever, you're dropping out of college, whatever your choice is. And you want to get an entry-level job somewhere. An advisor can be someone who got that entry-level job you want to get, mm-hmm. right? So let's say you want to become a software engineer and someone was like an engineer one, developer one at a company you want to work for. You could talk to a lot of different developer ones and they might give you conflicting advice. So take their advice with a grain of salt. If it's a very specific and high tier and difficult thing that they've achieved that you want to achieve.
Right, right.
There's fewer of them out there, so you should weigh their advice more heavily. So like one of my advisors is a world-renowned investor, right? Like there are very few people like him in the world, and I only get to talk to him like once every couple of years. Mm. Every time I've talked to him, if he says something or he recommends a book or he recommends any course of action, I weigh that very, very seriously and very heavily.
Right.
But if it were just like, Zach, which gym should I go to? Be like, well, you could ask any number of people who have been to a gym which one they should go to.
Yeah. So it's just sort of a consciousness of, you know, what this person has achieved mm-hmm. and how it relates to your own goals,
exactly.
right? How you weight their advice. That makes perfect sense. So one other question before we move on to talking about teachers. In these types of professional relationships, the other person's incentive to have it with you is obviously a very important consideration, right?
Absolutely.
So we're going to talk in detail. We've mentioned it a couple times already about mentors and being able to look at opportunity costs and pitching yourself to a mentor. Teachers, that's an easy one. You give them money.
Yep.
How do you properly incentivize someone to take the time to advise you?
First of all, you make it very easy for them to say no.
Okay.
You don't try to like pressure them into an area where they have to advise you.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing though too is, especially if you're relatively young, most people are totally happy to get on the phone with you.
Yeah.
Make it very easy for them. Make it very easy for them to give you input. Be very clear and make it clear that you will not waste their time.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing for somebody in an advisor role is to agree to hop on the phone with somebody for a short call, quote unquote, and it lasts an hour and the questions be very open-ended and they be very amorphous.
Mm.
Make it very clear what you want from them. Come with questions prepared. Make it very clear how much time you're going to take for them. And if it's in a way that you really sincerely admire what they've done and they've been able to achieve, make that clear too.
Yeah.
People are people. Like, people appreciate being appreciated.
Absolutely.
Treat human beings like human beings, and you'd be surprised at how many will at least reply to your email.
Yeah.
This isn't really an advisor role, but this is an example of this in cold email outreach. This is something I talk a lot about. I am getting endorsements for this book right now.
Right.
So you open up the book and you see all these quotations from like people who have achieved things saying that the book is great. And most of those, when you open up a book and you see those, are people that the author has known and built a relationship with, and asking the person to blurb the book is what that's called.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't a huge ask, right? Because like if I asked you to, you know, blurb a course I'm doing, you'd be like, sure. Right?
Yeah.
Because you and I know each other.
Right.
But there are some people you reach out to who you don't really know all that well. Maybe you've never even actually talked to them. This is actually an example of an advisor now that I think about it in greater detail. I reached out to a woman who is the CEO of a PR and personal branding agency to blurb my book, because there's a whole chapter on personal branding, how
right.
normal people can do that and use that to get ahead in their careers. And I made it very easy for her to say no. I told her I appreciate the work that she's done. I pre-ordered her book. The way I found her was that she actually is also a client of my literary agent.
Yeah.
So I used that as a hook to say, hey, by the way, we both know Leela Campoli, and would you like to blurb my book? Right.
Mm.
Very easy for her to say yes or no. So appreciate people, be sincere with them, you know, especially with authors in particular, like reach out to authors. This is something that very few people do. Most people, if they've written a book, they are more than happy to talk to someone who has bought that book.
Yeah. Writing a book is a pretty significant undertaking, if you ask me. And you nod. And, you know, people who've shown that commitment are probably warmer leads as far as people willing to have conversations with other people who are invested and curious about that subject.
Authors are teachers.
Yeah.
Like in the category of teachers, author is one of those types of people. Authors, coaches, course creators, consultants. No, those are all people who they specialize in taking concepts, ideas, strategies, tactics, and making them digestible for people.
Right. Let's talk specifically about teachers and the attributes of a quality teacher. Obviously, there's a lot of maybe apprehension with people in my audience when it comes to approaching teachers. I think we talked about this before. When I started working as a tutor, and I thought I was this cool, very revolutionary guy, it was at the time where I was realizing a lot of the problems with the school system and what real education meant versus schooling. And, you know, I went in there and I said, oh, we're going to have fun. This is going to be great. It was also around the time where I started to realize that any time that I was really feeling connected to a student, when I was having a breakthrough, when I was able to stimulate their interest in something, I'd always go, oh, shit, this isn't what we're supposed to be doing. Per your teachers. That was an important realization as well. But one of the things that I encountered again and again when I would go in for these initial meetings is they didn't want anything to do with me. Not that they were like completely disconnected, but I could tell they weren't enthusiastic about it. And sometimes they were really unhappy that I was there because I was an archetype, mm-hmm. you know, that they understood from previous experience. So back to the idea of self-directed learning, there are going to be times where we realize there are skills or knowledge that we don't have. We're going to have to go to somebody and hand them money to get it. So what are we looking for? How are we vetting these people when we do that?
There's a concept that Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater, author of a book called Principles that was very popular a couple years ago, has that I really like here. And this goes for hiring teachers. It goes for finding good podcast guests, you know, people to interview for your blog, any number of things. I use this concept a lot called believability.
Mm.
And believability comes down to, in the case of teachers, do they have a track record of successfully teaching what you want to learn? And are they able to adequately explain how they would teach it to you?
Right.
Those are the two things that you should look for. The track record, ask them for endorsements. Ask them for case studies. You know, if they do this professionally, they should have testimonials on their website, right?
Mm-hmm.
Past students, things like that. And then ask them how they would work with you based on the case of where you are coming from. They should be able to tailor their approach, if they're working one-on-one with you, this is, they should be able to tailor their approach based on your context. If you're not working one-on-one on that with them, you want to look for testimonials, case studies, things like that, and that they have worked with people like you.
Right.
So this would be like in buying a course. There are thousands of courses out there, and there you'll find that there are dozens of courses on the same topic. But just because there are dozens of courses on the same topic doesn't mean that they're all created equal. Different people may not have testimonials and evidence that they're able to do this. And others who do have those might not be able to do it with people who are like you and where you are coming from.
Right.
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 So just as an example, I both have a copywriting coach and bought a copywriting course somewhat recently within the last couple of years. And there are thousands of different copywriting materials out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought the course that I bought specifically because it's tailored for somebody with my background and what I want to achieve. I don't want to be a professional copywriter. I want to know how to do copywriting. I want to know how to write words that compel people to take action. But I don't want to like make this my career.
Right.
But there
right.
might be things out there for people who are like that. Right.
Right. Right.
So you want to take that all into account with believability. You want that they are actually versed in coaching or consulting or teaching, that they don't just spew words at you, that they can listen to you, that they can tailor what they're going to tell you based on your feedback.
There's a feedback loop, yeah.
Yeah, there's a feedback loop that if you hit one of these barriers that you're talking about earlier, they know how to help you get around those barriers, right?
Right, right.
In my case, just to give you an example, a client I've been working with has to manage up, meaning that he has a manager that he has to manage, right? This is something I actually have a lot of experience myself with, and I have a number of clients that I've worked with on this. So you'd want somebody who can actually help you when you run into problems with managing up in particular in his case.
Right.
And I actually think it's really important that they charge for their time. I know that this can be heresy in some of the like self-directed education communities, but valuable coaches, teachers, consultants, whatever you want to call them, know that their time is valuable. Mm. They've got relatively high opportunity cost, and it should be a red flag when they just give you their time for free.
Yeah. More importantly, they've proven to themselves and others that their time is valuable.
Yes.
Right.
People will get out their wallet and give them money for their time, which is a great signal that what they teach is actually valuable.
Right.
If somebody is giving out this is a conversation I had with somebody else recently who is building a course for software engineers, right? There's a lot of free software engineering courses out there, just as an example. And specifically in that community, like people can bristle sometimes at paid content. But if somebody is giving out their expertise for free, that either means that their expertise isn't valuable at all, or that they're like in the top 0.0001%.
Right.
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 And you just kind of have to use a bullshit meter to figure out which one it is. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's expand that a little bit. When we're talking about the weight to give them, how should people in these courses or working with these teachers go about evaluating what they're being told and how seriously? I mean, just like think about your college experience versus my college experience, right? You went to an Ivy League school that probably had a huge endowment that was probably on the cutting edge of most of the things it was doing. I don't know if there's such a thing as the opposite of an Ivy League school, but that's pretty much where I did my undergraduate years, studying a profession that was rapidly changing at the time that I was inside the school bubble, taught by people who apparently had no idea about these changes that were happening. So I wish I had at the time better skills to zoom out, to look at trends in an industry, to look how an industry was changing, and therefore zoom back in and say, is this person's advice or finger quotes knowledge even worth my time at this point?
Yeah. And there are two things I want to say to that real quickly before we talk about what weight to give people. The first is, we could have a whole separate conversation on research universities versus teaching colleges.
Sure.
Just because a university employs a lot of cutting edge researchers does not necessarily mean that they are good teachers, right?
Right. Absolutely.
They might be great advisors for that specific niche area, but they might not necessarily be great teachers. For the most part, I had what I think were pretty good teachers, but I think I got lucky in a lot of that.
Right. Right.
The other point that I would make is that somebody can use this cabinet of models approach if they are a student somewhere too, and they feel dissatisfied with their current teachers. If they feel like my teachers in my college have no idea what they're talking about, or they're not teaching me what I want them to teach me, I can reach out and I can find other teachers who may themselves work at other universities, or they might be for hire people in the private sector.
Right.
So that's something that I really like to hit home on people is, this cabinet of models, you can take it throughout your entire career before your career even starts.
Sure.
I was actually very fortunate that back when I wanted to be a philosophy professor, which is way back when, I had many teachers and advisors outside of my university who were able to elucidate that process for me and make it clear for me. And that's something that I just wish more students would do in general, no matter what they want to do. But an important thing to take into account when you're listening to teachers, is teachers have what I call domain expertise.
Right.
And this isn't a unique word to me. It's a phrase that's out there. There's been well studied. Domain expertise means that they know what they're teaching very well, but it does not necessarily mean that they know other things outside of that well.
Right.
Brian Kaplan, for example, has some good research in The Case Against Education on this, that just because you get really, really good at one thing, say taking tests, you're not necessarily good at things unrelated to that, right?
Yeah.
So for your teachers, give them a lot of weight in the area that they teach. Don't necessarily give them a lot of weight outside of that unless they prove believability.
Yeah. And it's a frustrating thing when somebody's trying to cut their own path and figure out something that I mean, so many things that people are doing today, even though there might be like a general model or general guidelines for how to do it, is something that's never been done before.
Yep.
What I do is something that's never been done before, even like down to the specifics, where I would hire somebody like, I need to improve the audio and video quality of this whole thing. There isn't anybody who can show me how to do, like, nobody has the sound card in this computer combined with my voice, combined with the editing software that I'm using, and just scale that out in every direction all over the place, right? This is like a unique puzzle that I'm putting together for the first time. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are doing that. So it really requires this conscious process of understanding needs and understanding goals. And nobody can, you know, put that together for you in the online education, but this is in so many online pursuits today. It's just like people are trying to figure something out for the first time.
I mean, I would just say in general, I think that people don't hire enough teachers.
Sure.
And I'm someone who, you know, I am 100% on team self-directed education. And I think to do self-directed education well, you should be humble and you should know, I don't know this, or it's going to take me so long to get through all the information out there and figure out which information I should take seriously and which information I should ignore.
Yeah.
I should just hire somebody to tell me this is the information I want to pursue.
Right, right.
So, like I said, I've got a copywriting teacher. I've got a public speaking teacher because I learned that, you know, my business teacher that I had can't help me specifically with doing public speaking. So I need to get a teacher there, right? I could have a teacher in any number of areas, and you can hire a teacher once, or you could have a multi-year relationship with them. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple teachers on retainer that I use. I've got some where it's like, if I need to learn a very specific thing, I will pay them to teach me that thing. So I'm right now looking at reaching out for a PR teacher, someone just to sit down with me and help me figure out a couple different headlines and angles that I can pitch to journalists.
Right.
That's a teacher in that very specific domain. It'll be half a day, right?
Yeah.
That's probably all I need them for.
Mm-hmm.
You can hire people. This is something that one of my advisors taught me very, very well, is that experts are out there for you to hire.
Because we're directing a lot of the advice on the show today towards young people, cost is going to carry more weight.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say somebody is shopping online courses, and we see a lot of things on like Coursera or Udemy that are $12. That seems to be a pretty normal price. Now, you've done online courses. Do you have any advice for going through that vetting process? Just when you're looking at a whole collection of things related to topics, when you have to compare and contrast, have you gained any wisdom from doing that yourself?
I tend to find that free courses are only very high quality when they're on very academic knowledge.
Okay.
So for example, I've taken a free course on federal taxes from the University of Illinois. Sorry, I'm almost falling asleep just talking about it. But it was a very good course because it was just taught through their business school by a guy who, like, that's what he specializes in, is teaching how federal taxes work.
Yeah.
Right? If you want tactical knowledge, if you want real-world tested knowledge, you typically have to pay. I tend to find that if a course costs less than $47, $49, it doesn't tend to be very high quality. The exception tends to be when somebody is just starting their career selling online content.
Yeah.
And they're starting low. So I have one teacher who I consider, you know, a friend here in Pittsburgh. He's a great social media guru, especially Twitter. He's just now starting to sell his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think he can charge thousands of dollars for it. He charges like $40, right? So you want to look at their track record.
Yeah, these are some extra considerations that there might be people who are really skilled at doing this thing, teaching this thing, and they don't know what to charge because right. they're not marketing experts, and that's why their prices are low, or they are marketing experts, and I mean, this is pretty common. They have something more expensive that they want you to buy later on, and suddenly this thing that might cost $29.95 or $49.99 is actually a good value because they're trying to use it to build trust.
Yep.
Right. So those are things like if somebody has a library of products, right? When you're searching Udemy or Coursera, like you can click and you can get a bio of the person and maybe they've done some other courses. But if they have a personal brand, right, they've attached their name, their reputation to this stuff, and they have a library of related products, I would say that's a good sign, as long as they're generally well reviewed, that those lower ticket items might be worth your time because they're trying to prove that they have value.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, for the people I find, especially those who've like they've built a personal brand around their expertise,
yeah.
98% of their content should be free.
Sure. Yeah.
Good content. Good high quality content. The 2% that remains, you should be more than happy to spend the money that they're asking you to spend on it.
Oh, amen. Right? I totally agree.
I don't believe that you should charge for everything. Especially like blog posts, ebooks, things like that. There's also like generally a whole marketing psychology to how much you can charge for info products. Like an ebook, typically you can't charge more than $49 for it. If someone's charging more than $49 for an ebook, it's like, that's kind of weird. Video content, especially if it's a whole video course, you can charge thousands of dollars for. A combination of ebook, video course, you can charge more. Audio courses, you know, a couple hundred dollars. So there's a lot of leeway here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I would want people to take away from this part of the conversation is simply like be willing to spend some money on curated good content. It should pay itself off for you. At the same time, if what you simply need is how to get to level one, don't buy the course that teaches you to get to level seven.
Right.
Like get what you need first, then buy the next thing, right? Like I spent money on good ebooks here or there that helped me get to the first level I needed to get to. Then I spent some money on some coaching that got me to the next level. Then I got to the point where it's like, okay, it might make sense for me to spend a couple thousand dollars on this course. Or it might make sense for me to spend a couple thousand dollars to sit down with this person for 2 hours and just get those 2 hours. But I wouldn't encourage someone who's just starting out to do that.
Right.
There's better uses of your money.
Awesome. So let's talk about mentors.
Yes.
Let's go at this the same way we did the other two. Great. And talk about qualities of an excellent mentor. And then we'll talk about how to actually find the right mentor.
Sounds great to me.
All right. So you also mentioned don't go to mentorship events looking for mentors.
If people bristle at this, if they hear, don't go to mentorship events if I want to find a mentor, my advice to them first is, have you been to mentorship events?
I have not. What are they like?
They're awful. They tend to be awful.
Okay. You know,
they tend to be. Sometimes they're good ones, but those are exceptions that prove the rule. The defining characteristic of a quality mentor is that they have, in all their decisions, high opportunity cost. Their time is very valuable, especially relative to where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have time, especially really good mentors, to go to a mentorship event.
Lurking around at mentorship events with people who can't help them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Drinking like bad coffee or like bad wine and like wearing a name tag, trying to shake hands with like clammy handed people. Right.
Right. Right. Like,
no, they just don't have time for that stuff. The exception that proves the rule again is if they do it as part of like a charitable giving and there's some sort of psychic benefit for them. So like, maybe you might find a good mentor at like the Boys and Girls Club or at one of their events or a fundraiser event or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are some exceptions, but the vast majority of the time, if you're just on like meetup.com and you're finding a mentorship event nearby, it's going to be awful for you.
Right.
Example, one of my clients, former client now, he's moved on to bigger and better things. He went to a mentorship event in Michigan on artificial intelligence. He's a machine learning specialist.
Mm.
He immediately called me after the event and told me, Zach, you were right. I should listen to you more often. He said that the vast majority of people there had no idea what they were talking about, that they had like seen AI in movies and they never actually stepped foot.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, these are the kinds of things that show
up. That's like a Star Trek convention.
I know, exactly. It's like, yes. Instead, it's better to do active outreach than to just like go to these things and think that you're going to bump into these people.
Right.
My advice generally is, as far as events go, because I also have a similar rule about networking events, don't go to networking events. Go to things that they have a secondary or a tertiary benefit of being networking, but their primary benefit is something else.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So like some of my best mentors I met at things like FEE seminars, the Foundation for Economic Education, right? Big fan of what FEE does.
Right.
The primary benefit of a FEE seminar is that you get to learn, right? It's kind of like a consumption good. It's fun for nerds to go to and like learn about nerdy stuff.
Right.
Networking is like a secondary or tertiary benefit. You're going to be in the same place as other people with similar interests to you, some of whom, especially speakers, are going to be further ahead in their careers than you, right?
Right.
So go to those. I'm not saying don't go to events, but don't go to things that are marketed as a mentorship event or
networking
event.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be stuffy anyway. Like it's, you know, just with dating, it'd be better to meet somebody at a party than at a speed dating thing.
Right. Yeah. Like the people, again, exceptions prove the rule. The people who are going to show up at like a singles night are probably
people
you want to date.
Oh.
Right? Like it's one of those things where it's like, if this is a quality person, why are they here? Right?
Yes.
With networking events, the areas I found exceptions are like if it's very early in the morning, that tends to be a little bit better because that means that the person is probably busy in the evening, which somebody with high opportunity cost should be busy in the evening.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, it's like just get introductions to these people instead. Network in a way that's just relationship building, doing outreach, asking for introductions, not like standing around giving out business cards at events.
Right.
So when it comes to mentors, it's better to find them in the capacity of somebody that you were working around or could work with that you'd like to work with and is probably too busy to go to something like a mentorship event.
Right. What should you be looking for as far as like their past is concerned or their reputation, I guess?
They lift people up. That's really important because you could work with somebody or work under somebody or work alongside somebody who is an egomaniac, who treats the people that they work with or work above as commodities.
Sure.
You want your relationship with your mentor to be one that when you outgrow your mentor, which you will, you should.
Right.
You are in a better place and they're happy for you to be in a better place.
Right. Yeah. And there's no jealousy.
Yeah. There's no jealousy. This is one of those things you just kind of have to feel out. If you see that they have previous mentees, people who worked under them who went on to do good things, like you can talk to them.
Yeah, this is what I was going to ask because this seems like the trick.
You want to talk to them, like, what was it like to work under this person, to work with this person? The more recent, the better, because if the person is, say, 10, 15, 20 years into their career and you talk to someone who worked under them as a mentee like 20 years ago, well, people evolve, right?
Right, right.
And I want to stress, if you went to this person, you asked them, oh, can you mentor me? Mm-hmm. Most of the time they'd be like, what? What you want instead to do is you want to go to them and you want to create value for them and earn the opportunity to work under them and learn from them.
Right. Right. Right.
So their time is very busy, is very valuable. They are what I call very busy people, VBPs. And they have a good history and track record of lifting people up, treating the people who are under them and with them as teammates, not as commodities.
Okay, so in the book, you put the quadrants, the four quadrants of, I feel like I first saw this in Stephen Covey's Seven Habits.
Yeah, the Eisenhower Matrix.
So urgent, not urgent, important, not important. They're operating where and you want to meet them where?
They're operating in everything they have to do is urgent and important.
Right.
Right. The way I like to think of important, if you're using – this is called the Eisenhower matrix or the urgent important matrix. It's called any number of things. You'll find it in a lot of different like management theory. The way I like to think about tasks that are important, these are tasks that only I can do, right? If I'm using this matrix to triage my own work.
Right, sure.
If a task is urgent, that means it needs to get done before not urgent tasks can get done.
Right.
Where you want to spend your time is you want to spend your time in the fourth quadrant, which is the urgent important quadrant.
Right.
The urgent important quadrant is these are tasks only I can do and they need to get done. Then you have tasks that are not urgent, but they're also important. Only I can do them, but they don't need to get done now. These are tasks that you typically schedule out they're ones you schedule out that you'll get done later, right?
Right, right.
Then you have tasks that are urgent, but not important. Not important doesn't necessarily mean that they are unimportant. It simply means that you don't necessarily need to be the person doing them.
Okay.
And this is where, as a mentee, your opportunity sits.
So are you always – you're not always attaching important to has to be done by the person in the mentor relationship because I feel like you could give – somebody important, non-urgent work to do if it's about, you know, strengthening the backbone of whatever you're doing. I mean, obviously, if there's urgent things like, you know, you think about starting, paint the fence, wax the car, those kinds of things that might be urgent, not important. A person who's being mentored could operate in important. They could expect to get
some of
that.
We're getting into some weird semantics here.
Sure.
About what the definition of important is.
Okay.
When I like to think about important, I like to think of it from the perspective of the person who is triaging or prioritizing their work.
Okay. So it's right? subjective. Sure.
It's totally subjective. Right. Something that for the very busy person might not be important could be very important for the organization. Mm-hmm. Right? So in a good company, for example, let's say it's a business-to-business kind of like service company, does consulting, big ticket items, right? Typically, the CEO, let's say you want the CEO to be your mentor. The CEO should be doing some of the sales, right? They should be doing the closing and the sales. They should probably be in on the negotiating if it's a relatively small team. They don't necessarily need to be doing the outreach to get that conversation started. Right?
Right, right.
That's a very important task. That has to get done for the business to operate. But in the grand scheme of things that the CEO should be spending their limited number of hours every day working on,
right,
somebody else might be able to do it. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the way that Stephen Covey presents the Eisenhower Matrix is the quadrant that is not, is urgent but not important is the delegate quadrant. Just because you're delegating something to somebody else doesn't mean it's not important for the organization. It's just not necessarily important for you to do.
Okay. Right? Urgent, not important.
Right.
Delegate.
That's where your opportunity really sits, because what you really want to find is you want to find those tasks that are urgent and important for the organization, and they take some kind of skill in order to do.
Right, right.
But that it's not so important that the very busy person needs to be the one doing it.
Right? Gotcha.
These are the things that just kind of like fall off their plate that in an ideal world, the very busy person could do, but there's a limited number of hours in every day. You want to be careful here because there are other tasks that fall into urgent and not important that are kind of like assistant tasks.
Right, right.
You don't want to be an assistant, right? You want to be more of an apprentice or more of a mentee. You don't want to be like an executive assistant, right?
Okay.
Not that there's anything wrong with being a VA or being an EA, but the kinds of tasks that a VA or EA should do are what I call like relatively low skill,
mm-hmm.
but still important, or it's still urgent tasks for the organization, right?
That's important, right? A few minutes ago when I said wax the car, paint the fence, those were jokes, references to the 1984 movie Karate Kid. But which seems like they would be assistant tasks, sort of meaningless time filler tasks, are actually the most important things that Daniel could ever learn. He just didn't know because it wasn't explained. So those were bad. Those were bad examples. But I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of kind of like distinction and nuance in here. Right.
Right. Sure.
So, for example, one of my mentors used to be Isaac Morehouse, the CEO of Praxis.
Yep.
When I approached Isaac to work under him, I didn't ask him like, "Hey, I want to organize your receipts." Right. That's something right, that a VA right. could do, and a good VA probably should do, right, if he doesn't already have a system set up. And I want to stress, there's nothing wrong with being a VA. A good VA is worth their weight in gold. But unless you want to become a VA, this is not the kind of stuff that you need to be doing.
Right, right.
Instead, I approached him and said, you know, I know that you're building up this program. At the time, there was like this whole online portal to it, that you're doing some content marketing. These are things I could do for you. I could do content marketing. I know how to write. I can write on your blog. I can put some stuff into the portal. Those are things that if I had not approached him, he probably would have had to have done himself. But in the grand scheme of the day, like, there are more important things for him as CEO of launching a startup that he should probably be doing.
You could also bring these things to the table, I would think, because like if you're trying to communicate that you have value and you respect that this person's time is important, you don't want to go to them and say, well, what do you need? I mean, right. maybe what do you need? Because it's like, now you're giving me another thing to do, right. generate a list of things that I need.
Right.
You could, and I think you mentioned this in the book, you could look at the competitors. If competitors exist for what this person is doing, what are some things? And so obviously you have to bring some background knowledge to this process if you're going at it this way, right? So if you're talking about two websites, right? Praxis had a website. Maybe they didn't have a lead magnet,
right?
Right. Maybe there wasn't a way of directing people towards or a clear way, step-by-step way of directing people towards ultimately enrolling in the program. And you say, well, I have a little marketing knowledge. I have some copywriting knowledge. I could put a lead magnet on the front page to get people to opt in to an email list.
Yep.
Right. And I could write an autoresponder email sequence.
There's any yeah. number of ways that you can approach actually getting the mentor. And it's going to depend on where you're coming from. The Praxis example for me personally, it was like my first opportunity out of university.
Right, right.
So those are like relatively, to me now, like I wouldn't write blog posts for a company blog or put things in a portal. I'd hire someone to do that, an intern.
Right.
But at the time, those were valuable tasks for me to engage in. If I were to go find a mentor now, I'd be pitching totally different kinds of tasks based on the skills and the value that I can bring to the table.
And obviously the person's network.
Oh,
when
yeah.
you were looking at a mentor, the network is extremely important here.
Yep.
So how should a person go about evaluating that?
You want someone who's networked with people that you would like to network with, have in your network, but
right.
you probably can't access right now. Great example here, just again from my own personal experience, like previously what Isaac had done was he was a fundraiser for the Institute for Humane Studies. So his network was a lot of business owners. It was a lot of people that I just wanted to learn from, and that as someone who was like coming out of university, I didn't have in my network and were kind of, I had no idea how to access at the time. Now I've got a better idea. Like I can teach people how to do cold emails and like you could build this network yourself.
Right.
But you could also work closely with a mentor and absorb their network.
Yeah.
And the social proof that comes with their network. Right.
Yeah.
So along the lines, you could reach out to someone who they may know and you can say, hey, I worked under or work with this person. Right. And if I reach out to someone you know and you know well, and I say, hey, I've been on Brett Vinat's podcast a couple times. Brett and I get along, yada, yada, yada. That person's more likely to reply to me. They're more likely to engage with me and they're more likely to take me seriously. I'm a couple steps ahead in the relationship building process than if I just totally emailed that person cold.
Right.
A good mentor should be someone who is pretty well connected for the types of people you want to be connected to.
Okay. Now, we talked about opportunity cost and this being a VBP.
Very busy person.
But there has to be some kind of balance with like some availability.
Yes.
In this case.
Yeah, they need to be accessible to you, right?
Okay.
As you advance in your career, people who are formerly inaccessible to you will become accessible to you.
Right, right.
So a lot of the examples I've given here are like early career examples, but you can actually take and apply this concept to being later in your career. If you're an executive, right, at a medium-sized company, you might be able to get somebody as a mentor in a transition to a new company who is an executive at a Fortune 500.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. But if you're just starting out, that might be really hard just to get that person to reply to your email or even to know who to go to as that mentor. You're going to gain skills. You're going to gain social proof. You're going to gain your own network that makes this person more accessible. So it depends on where you're starting out.
All right. So I think that's everything. We could just review the step-by-step process here, make that explain. That's not too much to give away for free, is it?
You know, I was talking to one of my advisors who's sold a book about a decade ago, did very well. I asked him, I was like, I've heard that some people, they just listen to podcasts and then they don't buy the book. Should I really do podcast interviews? And he's like, well, those people weren't going to buy your book anyway, right? I like to think that this book has so much actionable content in it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to give away, again, 98% of it for free.
Sure.
I've got email scripts in this book. I've got step-by-step breakdowns, case studies, links to things on the website that you don't get to access unless you have the book.
Right.
So I'm more than happy to go into this. Sure.
Awesome.
And your listeners are very good also at emailing me. So I tell people you can reach out to me and start this conversation as well.
Oh, that's terrific. You got a lot of people joining your list from
I've
from
had
here?
A couple people join my list and then shoot me an email saying like, oh, I heard you on the School Sucks show. So surprisingly, actually somewhat older people too, which I was a little surprised by. I'm happy to talk to anybody, but it's been cool. Yeah,
yeah. I broke all the content on our website down into 16 categories, you know, and you are most frequently appearing in a category called Instead of College.
Oh, cool.
So I am thinking that maybe some of these older people are parents.
Yeah, some of them are.
Yeah.
One or two have reached out to me and said, like, I've got kids, 14,
yes,
17,
parents
things
of teens.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yep. So I always tell people, like, if you go to my website, zachslayback.com, there's a contact Zach
yeah.
page, which is to contact me if you want to have me on a podcast, if you want me to do a workshop for your company, but it's also just if you have any questions. My email address is there. It's Zach, Z-A-K, dot Slayback, S-L-A-Y-B-A-C-K, at getaheadlabs.com. Mm. People can email me. So
awesome.
I'm more than happy to go into this.
Cool. So when we're looking for a mentor, the step-by-steps are, we talked about identifying people who are busy.
Yep.
Right?
Because that's where your opportunity sits. No matter where you are in your career, there will be somebody whose time is more valuable than yours.
Right.
Unless you're like Jeff Bezos, which like now he's getting divorced, so I'm sure he's probably got more – he needs more people helping him.
Yeah.
Unless you're like at the very top of the food chain, there's still going to be somebody whose time is more valuable than yours. And even in their case, like in different realms of their lives, there are people who are better at certain things than they are that they want to get better at.
Right.
Right. So find someone who is busier than you, whose time is really valuable.
Right. And then strategizing on ways you can connect with them.
Yeah. So it could be introductions. It could be reaching out to them cold. I typically like to think of it as inbound or outbound. Do you have a network or do you have to do outreach?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And doing outreach really comes down to, if you've never done sales, it's really just business development. It's, I have a spreadsheet I give my clients where it's, if they want to network with someone to get hired at a company, you know, what's the name of the company? Who's the person who you'd like to contact there? What's their LinkedIn profile? What's their Twitter handle? What's their Facebook profile? If someone's friends with them on Facebook and you've got a mutual friend, that's probably a personal connection.
Yeah.
Check on LinkedIn. Do you have any mutual connections on LinkedIn? If you do, they'll have a little second next to their name, right? That shows that they're a second level connection. Ask for introductions. If you don't have those, that's fine. You can do a cold email. What should your cold email look like? Well, there's a whole structure into that. That's a whole separate thing I teach. But find a way to get an introduction or to reach out to them cold.
Right. So doing some background. If you do have to go cold, then doing some background research, looking at, like I talked about and like you talk about in the book, looking at their competitors. What are the competitors doing that you're not? What do they need? And building a value proposition that you could bring to them, right?
Yep.
Then the presentation matters. And, you know, you want to show, look, I'm not here to waste your time.
Yep.
I have knowledge. I think I can help you. Maybe some bullets on how should that process unfold once you get to that step?
So you're going to assume that they're very busy.
Yeah.
But that they also have problems that they need to solve.
Right.
And that you can help them solve these problems. Right. You should reach out to them with a one-pager proposal, value proposition, whatever you want to call it. Right. And you should tell them, based on what I was able to figure out about you and your company, if you haven't talked to them yet, if you have talked to them, there are certain questions you should ask them. You should ask them what their bottlenecks are, where they'd like to be in a year, things like that. But if you're totally doing it cold, you've never talked to them before, tell them, here's what I think I can do. Here's a one pager of what I would do for you. Does this interest you? If so, we can set up, I'd love to set up a time to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can tell them too, even if it doesn't interest you, please feel free to keep the one pager and use it however makes sense to you. If you think there's a high likelihood that they will reply to you and that you're able to keep this conversation going, you can actually make what you're proposing to them and give it to them, right?
Right,
so
right.
The example you gave earlier is just a really accessible one that I really like, which is creating a lead magnet for a website. If you're interested in marketing or you're interested in getting your foot in the door at any kind of company, this is a great way to do it if the company is growing, because a company probably will only hire somebody if they're growing, right?
Right,
that's an important distinction to have here. So there's a number of different resources I turn people to find companies that are growing, to find companies that will actually hire. There's Inc. 5000 list. It's the fastest growing companies in the country, 5000 fastest that submitted to Inc., but pretty good list. Every city, every major metro tends to have their own thing, like the Pittsburgh Business Times or the Philadelphia Business Journal that has their own list of fastest growing companies in the region.
Yeah.
Crunchbase, where you can find if companies recently raised money from investors, they need to hire, resources like that, right? But you can reach out to them. You can say, I'd like to build a lead magnet for you. I saw you don't have one on your website. I would use MailChimp, Optin, Monster, any number of different tools. I actually went ahead and I put one together of your most popular blog posts, and it's in a PDF attached. I'd love to chat with you about if you need a marketing associate. Would that interest you? Which is a yes-no question, very easy to reply to. If so, I can send along. Sometimes it might make sense. And then you can say in the postscript, you know, I get that you're really busy, and if you don't have this opportunity open, I understand. Please feel free to still use the lead magnet attached. The reason you do these things is not necessarily to give them the perfect thing to hire you for. It's to signal traits that people want to have in people working with them.
I think it also diffuses like a subtle – something that occurs to us when we are very busy people and we get a lot of email,
yeah.
Right? When an email appears and it says, I'm a big fan or I love your show – oh, gosh, I feel terrible saying it, but the first thing that goes through my mind is, what do you want? If I've never heard of them before.
Yeah.
Right? Now, it's I'm not saying it's an annoyance, but there is a calculation.
Totally open-ended emails that are trying to be helpful.
Yeah.
But are totally open-ended, unfortunately tend to destroy more value than they create.
But then usually it's like 8 to 10 paragraphs, right? And I say, oh, this person wants my time. But if somebody said, look, it's going to take you 15 minutes to read this email. So here, I attached two Word documents. I transcribed your last two podcasts.
That's great.
I don't know if that would be useful for SEO, but I think it would be, they say. I say, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
You've bought into the conversation.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, that's like, I mean, compared to some people, my opportunity costs are fairly low, right? Like, and my time is valued at a much lower rate than a lot of the people that, you know, the people we're directing the show to might be reaching out to for advice or mentorship. So to be able to diffuse that suspicion, I'm calling it suspicion for lack of a better word, when you reach out to somebody cold and you say, maybe this is about what can you do for me, but here's what I can do for you. Here's what I did for you. I already did, past tense.
You want to signal conscientiousness. You want to signal industriousness, that you're not going to be a time suck, right?
Mm.
I'm not saying that cold emails need to be short. They need to be as long as necessary to convey the point that you want to convey.
Right.
Right? And they need to give value and add value to the person you're emailing. There's an old joke. I heard it through Zig Ziglar. He took it from someone else. He's an old sales guru.
Right, sure.
But it's, what is the world's most popular radio station? WII-FM. What's in it for me? Mm-hmm. That's my Zig Ziglar impersonation. But you always have to ask yourself, when you're reaching out to someone cold, anybody, but especially someone who's busier than you, what's in it for me?
Yeah.
There are tangible things that might be in it for them. And then there are some things that, again, that we talked about earlier. They're human beings. Like, they want their egos to be massaged a little bit,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, sure.
So, for example, when doing these book blurb emails, I put both in it. It's like, one, your name and your company name and your website are going to appear on the Amazon page and inside the book. And if the book does very well, that will be good for you, too.
Yeah, sure.
And two, it would really mean a lot to me. I really admire your work, and I bought your book.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like, simple. What's in it for me? You'll appear in the front page of the book. Could be valuable.
Right. Right.
So always ask yourself, what's in it for them to reply to this email? And there are a number of ways you can find this out. You can actually talk to them. If you can get to talk to them first before you send the email, before you put the value proposition in front of them, that's great. Don't ask them, what can I do, though? Because it's like, that's open-ended. I don't know. There's a ton of things you can do. There's 1,000 things you can do.
Right, right.
Right? Instead, ask them, what are your biggest bottlenecks? What are the things that you'd love to get done that you just don't have the time to get done right now? Right?
Absolutely.
There's a good book called The Dan Sullivan Question that is by Dan Sullivan, who's this runs a program in Toronto called Strategic Coach that one of my mentors is in. And the Dan Sullivan question generally looks like this. I'm probably going to botch it, but it's along the lines of, if you were sitting down and looking back at this conversation 3 years down the line, what will have needed to have happened in order for you to be glad that we worked together, right?
Mm.
And I like this because it forces the person to think a couple years down the line, think back in a positive frame, and then think about what their goals are and how they achieve those goals.
Right, right.
Something like that's helpful. You can compare them to their competitors, see if they have any obvious competitors, and if they're not doing something, if there's value they're dropping on the floor.
Right.
And you can also ask your advisors. Find an advisor who does what this person does, or did what this person did, or worked with this kind of person, and ask them, you've worked with a sales executive of a 200-person software company. What's something that doesn't get done there that's really valuable to get done?
Right. Right. Yeah.
And your advisor can help you there too. Like, pull on your cabinet.
In closing, one of the things that I think has become a problem over, you know, the end of the last century and into this century is personal relationships are missing from lots of young people's professional development, professional growth.
Absolutely.
As you mentioned in this chapter of the book, and as we've talked about, gosh, almost endlessly on this podcast, referencing, you know, Gatto's work, because Gatto talks about this all the time. Apprenticeships and mentorships used to be how a young person obtained skills and wisdom, right? By working with an older person. People go to age-segregated schools. they are taught, again, back to the negative perception of teachers, it comes from there, by people who often have not done, right? I mean, that's the place where that occurs most frequently. And I know you advise against that in the book. Don't say teachers are people who can't do. But I have to think that expression, that cliche grew out of
people. I mean, there are good and bad teachers.
Oh, there certainly are.
That's a reality. But there are some people who are good at teaching who are good at teaching a subject matter, even if they haven't achieved the level of success that you want to go to there.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying that everybody who can't do necessarily should teach.
There's a lot of well-intentioned people working in a kind of poisonous and restrictive environment. Mm-hmm. And that hurts, right? Because when I've talked about teachers, I had a handful of good teachers. And the ones who weren't, it wasn't that they were bad people or that they were innately lazy people. A lot of them I could tell. And especially in retrospect, there are people who've been worn down by the system. So we can't mount a defense against public school teachers because, my eighth grade history teacher was terrific. So teachers are fine, because we wouldn't evaluate dentists that way if one time we had a good one.
Yep.
And 20 were bad. And then people leave the school experience. They go on to college. They might go to some impersonal internship. These opportunities that self-directed learners, homeschoolers and unschoolers, can start cultivating, before schooled people get their first crack at an internship when they're 20, people can be cultivating these relationships and looking for these things, and parents can be helping 12, 13, 14 years old.
When I met Josh, who I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, Josh Blackman, I remember I was young enough that I couldn't drive to Johnstown where he worked. So I must have been like 14, 15
years old. There's a place.
Oh, man. Don't get me started on Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
There's a place in Pennsylvania.
He worked for the federal judge, and there's a federal courthouse in Johnstown, which is in an old dilapidated Macy's or something like that. It's, of course, where the federal courthouse in Johnstown is.
Yeah.
A shut down department store. That makes sense.
Yeah.
At least it's not a deprecated factory.
Johnstown, by the way, just for international and national listeners, Johnstown is a place that as you're driving by it on I-76, you go, oh my God, what is this place?
Okay, you don't pass Johnstown from 76, to be fair. You pass Somerset. And then you
The big thing when you're headed into Pittsburgh on the left, that big city on the hill there that looks all run down, smoky?
No.
No?
No, Johnstown's off 22.
I'm sorry. Sorry to Johnstown.
Yeah, or wherever you just
insulted. I thought some other shitty city was Johnstown.
It is one of the fastest shrinking cities in the country. It's an interesting place. It was about 20, 25 minutes from where I grew up. It's a couple hours east of Pittsburgh. But I remember, I was probably 14, 15 years old, and he's still someone I can call on, ask for advice. He's going to be blurping the book, things like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's a relationship that I started. Because I was a particularly weird and proactive kid, but that's one that you can do if you're homeschooled, unschooled, anything like that, particularly easily. And I was lucky to have parents who were pretty supportive of me doing my own thing.
Yeah, yeah. So for people in my audience who are interested, is there a pre-order process for this book at this early stage?
We are in the early stages. Right now, you can pre-order the book on Amazon. It's How to Get Ahead. The page that is up on Amazon actually is the page that we gave to like purchasers at bookstores. So I didn't even know it would go up on Amazon.
Yeah.
But you could pre-order it there. You'll get what's called a pre-order price guarantee, meaning that when the price comes down, what I expect to happen is that the actual price of the book will go up because hardcover books are actually quite expensive. But then Amazon tends to discount books when they launch. So you actually get the discounted price of the book. So you'll probably pay less than what it's up right now. What I will be doing, if you're listening to this episode probably in February, you should be able to go to zachslayback.com/book or another URL that I will give Brett. Pre-order the book from Amazon on there. And then you'll get a number of bonuses as a pre-order of the book, probably about $500 to $1,000 worth of bonuses, things like email scripts, checklists, miniature courses, nano courses that I've put together to make this book the best thing that you can buy for your career in 2019.
Awesome. Well, Zach, thank you for stopping by. It's always a pleasure. It's always a very educational experience.
Thanks for having me, Brett.
We'll have to do this again soon, maybe when the book comes out. But there's plenty of things that we can always
talk
about.
We can talk about Pittsburgh. We can talk about the scary neighborhood that we can see from your porch when there isn't when there aren't leaves and we're confused about what's over there, like we were before this conversation started.
We're gonna have to do a show about pierogi sales. Is that what they're called?
Oh man.
You said you were going to take me to one of these.
I got to take you to a pierogi sale, and I have to give you the Three Rivers cookbook, or at least a link to it.
All right.
Because the culinary culture of Pittsburgh is simultaneously one of the most interesting, delicious, and disgusting that I've ever come across.
Yes, perfect.
I love it, and I hate it at the same time, and it is wonderful. So we'll have to we can do an episode on pierogi sales. What we should do is like a deep dive into like civic society, like de Tocqueville kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And how that is supported through like the old Pittsburgh that is still here.
Yeah, I love that idea. I'm looking forward to it getting nicer and getting out and exploring again.
It'll be really
nice. I feel like
the spring is nice.
Yeah. The spring and summer here are beautiful. The winter's a little tough. The fall is gorgeous too, yeah. Because the hills and the foliage.
Yeah, but it's one of the most beautiful cities in the fall. It's just, it gets so gray in the winter.
Gray and brown, two colors that clash.
Yep.
Gray sky, brown earth. There's no evergreens here.
No, there aren't.
You know, like in New Hampshire, things, like all the pine, like things stay green all year.
Yeah.
And here, it is just brown. And like, you know, we're up on a hill.
Yep.
I like to live on a hill, if I can. And
just not the hill that Johnstown is on in your mind.
It's a shitty hill. But just as far as you can see in every direction, it's just brown. So, I mean, we've got, you know, two solid months of that left. And then, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, the first time I came here was winter. But when I came back, it was the spring of last year. And I just couldn't believe how beautiful this place was.
It's a gorgeous place.
Absolutely. So there's lots of stuff we can do, and we'll do more of it in the future. Thanks again for coming by.
Thank you, Brett.